On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail. But what about the promise to build the wall and make Mexico pay for it? What about the promise?
There's no longer an onus for the candidates to take substantive stands.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
We got a call from our agent one day that basically said, oh, Marvel has a list of 10 filmmakers that they want to talk to about the next Captain America movie, and you guys are on it.
Anthony Russo and his brother Joe had directing credits on TV shows, including Arrested Development and Community, when they were recruited to make a leap into the big-budget world of comic book movies. Now they've followed up Captain America Winter Soldier with another blockbuster, Captain America Civil War. They tell us how they went from making an indie film on a credit card to commanding an army in the Marvel Universe. But first on the news banter, anxiety for the animators who brought you Madagascar and Kung Fu Panda. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
So, Matt, DreamWorks Animation, I think we've mentioned before that it was acquired for $3.8 billion by NBC Universal. A lot of anxiety on the campus of DreamWorks Animation. They have a really nice spread in Glendale. Even though it's changed somewhat with the constraints of recent years, it's really old school approach to animation that Jeffrey Katzenberg took there. Big teams working on movies, nice furniture, free lunches, you know, things that are perks that, you know, used to be the norm everywhere in animation. But NBC Universal's Illumination, which does the Despicable Me movies, has a really different approach to the business.
Yeah, these are two companies that are now under the same NBC Universal roof, Illumination and DreamWorks Animation, and the cultures of these companies could not be more different. As you illuminated in a story in The Hollywood Reporter this week, the culture at DreamWorks Animation is very Hollywood-oriented, very filmmaker and animator-friendly. The culture at Illumination is, you know, people are spread all over the world. The budgets for the films are about $80 million rather than $140 million at DreamWorks. Now you've got this company, Comcast and NBC Universal, that are trying to run both companies and bring a little bit of the frugality of Illumination to DreamWorks Animation and a little bit of the quality and skill set of DreamWorks Animation to the Illumination people. And, you know, you saw the CEO of Comcast, Brian Roberts, and the CEO of NBC Universal, Steve Burke, actually came out to Glendale last week and said, you know, we're here to make you guys better. We are going to still make films under this DreamWorks Animation banner. And they felt they needed to go out and assuage these concerns.
Yeah, at the same time, you know, the Steve Hewlett of the Animators Guild, the union, said, you know, he predicted before this even happened on the campus of DreamWorks Animation that they would come and they would say whatever they had to say to soothe the people who work there because they don't want everybody to panic in the middle of making films. And then the axe would start to fall. And I think most DreamWorks animators fear that.
Yeah, there will definitely be layoffs in this situation. It's pretty much inevitable. But if you look at what Comcast and NBC Universal are trying to do here, there's a clear model. They're trying to do what Disney does. Disney had Disney Animation Studios. It was not doing that well. They went out and they bought Pixar Animation Studios. They put them all under one leader in John Lasseter. Same thing, DreamWorks Animation and Illumination are going to be under Chris Meledandri, the leader of Illumination. And at Disney, at least, it's really worked out. Frozen and Zootopia are Disney Animation Studios films that probably would not have been possible if John Lasseter had not come over from Pixar and reinvigorated that animation division.
Yeah, so we'll see if Meledandri can do this with this very different style, as you say, far-flung animators directly reporting to the director instead of to, you know, sitting in a room together and people communicating via Skype. It's all very, very different. I'll just briefly say Jeffrey Katzenberg, of course, the founder of DreamWorks Animation, and before that he was at Disney. This is the end of a long run, about 30 years for him in animation at one place or another. And he really did revive that art form. You know, when he got to Disney, initially he and Michael Eisner were like, eh, animation, what, you know, it's not really working. Let's farm it out overseas and do something cheap. Roy Disney would not hear of it. And Jeffrey Katzenberg then took over and, you know, really made it work. And starting with Little Mermaid, and when he left Disney, he had reached the pinnacle of The Lion King, and he went on to do Shrek and a lot of popular movies at DreamWorks Animation. Big change not having him in the picture anymore.
Big question also, what's he going to do next?
Yeah, what is he going to do next? And we will see maybe something in the digital world. Meanwhile, you are getting on a plane pretty much any moment to go to Cannes. And we are seeing, you know, the impact of the digital world, where Jeffrey Katzenberg may or may not reside in the future, at Cannes.
Absolutely. The Cannes Film Festival is sort of the pinnacle of old school film culture. And this year, the opening film, Woody Allen's Café Society, is an Amazon Studios film. They went in and they bought up Woody Allen's next film. And I think you're going to see Amazon and maybe even Netflix be a little bit of a disruptor this year at the film festival. But there's a big dichotomy between the two of them. Amazon has really been embraced by the film community and the directors community because they are adhering to these theatrical windows. They're not putting the films directly onto their service. They're allowing them to play in theaters before going on to the Amazon Prime Video service. Netflix has been pretty adamant that they want their films to premiere day and date, so-called, on Netflix, and if there's any theatrical component, in theaters as well. So what you're seeing here is Netflix is going to have a hard time when one of its biggest rivals is Amazon, and they are being embraced by the film community.
Yeah, I mean, I do wonder whether Netflix is going to have to cave on this because it does cost them. We saw it with Beasts of No Nation. You know, this was a movie that did not get the nominations they would have wanted. It did not play much in theaters because they insisted on putting it on Netflix day and date. They've certainly been willing to spend the money. We've seen that at Sundance. But, you know, this thing with the theater owners, they're going to fight to the bitter end, and the studios have to watch themselves because even if you think the theaters are going into the sunset, they sure aren't there yet.
Absolutely. And the filmmakers, that's the key component here. The filmmakers, for the most part, want a theatrical release. And that's the big thing. Amazon is willing to give it to them. And Netflix, maybe, maybe not. And we don't really know. And maybe it'll get a couple weeks. But Amazon is committing to this. And that's giving them a leg up.
Yeah. So, of course, films will be on sale at Cannes. You know, that's a market. And we'll see who does better. I mean, up until now, Netflix has been pretty much triumphing completely, certainly when it comes to awards recognition. Both of them hide their numbers. But we'll see whether people start now, at least in the film side, shifting over to Amazon. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. The abundant action in Marvel's Captain America Civil War begins when world governments move to restrict the activities of the Marvel superheroes to dial back on the collateral damage that occurs when bad guys have to be taken down. Iron Man, played obviously by Robert Downey Jr., agrees to go along, but Captain America, or Chris Evans, isn't so sure. The American Secretary of State, played by William Hurt, tries to convince him.
Captain, while a great many people see you as a hero, there are some who'd prefer the word vigilante. You've operated with unlimited power and no supervision. That's something the world can no longer tolerate.
Soon the superheroes are split into opposing camps, leading to so many battles that it's amazing even two directors could handle it all. That was a job for brothers Joe and Anthony Russo. Not unlike many of their super subjects, they had an unassuming start. Two cinephiles who grew up in Cleveland, inspired by indie icons like Robert Rodriguez and the Coen brothers. The two decided to make a movie of their own, which they paid for with credit cards. Their film, Pieces, got into Slam Dance in 1997. Joe Russo explains what happened next.
I was at UCLA at the time. I was a graduate student at film school, and I was in graduate housing right off of Sepulveda Boulevard. And I think I was cooking mac and cheese for my wife and our newborn baby. Obviously, the mac and cheese was for my wife and I. And the phone rings, and I pick it up, and a voice on the other end says, "Is this Joe?" And I said, "Yep." And he said, "Hi, this is Steven Soderbergh. I saw your movie at Slam Dance. I loved it, and I want to sit down and talk to you guys about helping you out."
Did you like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God?
Well, of course, the first thing you think is that somebody is messing with you. So I was, you know, a lot of film school buddies, you know, I was trying to figure out who it was. And he slowly convinced me that it was truly him. And
did you go, who is this really?
I did.
You really did?
Yeah, I was laughing. and then we ended up setting a lunch date and everything kind of went from there.
And where was he at that point?
He had reached a point where his movies were
not... Out of sight.
This was before Out of Sight. His movies weren't making money. And so when we sat with him for the first time, here he is as our filmmaking god, sitting across from us at Versailles in Venice, sharing roast pork with us, and telling us that they couldn't get his movies made, and that he was about to go make a movie with George Clooney, who was coming off a television show at the time. And I think Steven felt a little conflicted about this, that he was selling out, and he was going to go do a commercial film for Universal, but he had to in order to keep his career moving forward. We got to learn, as he got to learn, how to work in the business. And he developed an attitude once he and Clooney fell in love with each other, had a great working relationship, and started Section 8. They taught us very early on that it's one for you, one for them, and that you have to advance your career with something commercially viable, and then you have a lot of opportunity to do things that are less commercially viable.
This is a lesson he's giving to guys who like couldn't have been more commercially unviable with like what we did with our first movie. So,
are you still in touch with him?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
What does he make of your career? You're locked up for a long time. The one for you, I don't see where the one for you is going to happen because you're doing a lot for them.
We did one for us for a while in television. We had a lot of commercially unsuccessful shows over the years.
Yeah. Arrested Development and Community, and those were kind of our, like, those were our indie movies on TV.
They were so. Labors of love.
I don't think people regard those as unsuccessful. I mean, financially, they may not have been, like, the Brass Ring, Big Bang Theory
right.
hit, but they're beloved.
They managed to stay on the air because of critical acclaim, but every episode was a struggle because you're working on shows that, you know, again, you're lucky to be on the air with. So, you know, they're economically restrained shows, and you're constantly in battle with the network about the content. So to us, they were difficult.
And the movie transition, I mean, Steven Soderbergh, he produced your film.
That's right.
Welcome to Collinwood.
Right, which was not commercially successful. I think it made a grand total of $300,000 in U.S. theaters.
Yeah, about
Did
that.
You sort of think, well, we're just not connecting at movies, so let's do TV?
No, it was a little happenstantial.
Yeah, I think with Collinwood, look, Collinwood was a very specific experience. Soderbergh and Clooney had just formed their company at Warner Brothers, Section 8, and they were making Ocean's 11 for the studio. So they had an immense amount of leverage there. And Soderbergh at the time basically said to Warner Brothers, you know, if I'm going to have this big label here, I want to be able to move some smaller movies through the system. And this was, you know, before Warner Independent was around.
And which so is we no became, longer around.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
Yeah, that was short.
Right. Well, we were sort of the first test case, so to speak. We were this little movie that they moved through their system. And it just never really took. You know, they didn't really know how to handle a movie of that size. It was just a mismatch. I think that we always wrote that experience off to that. But we just got lucky because that was right in the wake of HBO sort of changing TV with The Sopranos. So all of a sudden, there was a rush on indie filmmakers
To work in television.
Yeah, to work in TV. Like Kevin Reilly was running FX at the time, and he was making a show called Lucky, which was a very dark comedy about a degenerate gambler. He came into the edit room while we were editing Welcome to Collinwood, took a look at the edit with the Cullen brothers who had written that, and they hired us to make that pilot. And that pilot, we shot it in a very indie film style. While the show didn't work on FX, that pilot became an industry favorite. Everybody loved that pilot. We got a ton of meetings off that pilot. And one of the meetings we got off that pilot was with Imagine. And they were making Arrested Development at the time.
Right.
And then, you know.
What was happening that was interesting at the time that I think is very evident now is that the indie scene that we grew up in was transitioning to television. And I think now, right. if you look at the marketplace, the right. spirit of what was happening in the 80s and the 90s is now the same spirit that is embracing television.
So you're in there doing that, which is more your vibe,
right.
no matter how difficult, I guess.
I wouldn't necessarily say that it is more our vibe. It's, you know, this is a kind of an
interesting... Actually, your vibe, yeah, because that is almost like ridiculous to say right now.
Yeah, because in a way, the work we're doing with Marvel, I don't think is a true one for them because it's, you know, it actually cuts very close to the bone for us on a creative level in terms of what we like to do. There's a lot that inspires us about these Marvel movies that is, you know, we have a lifelong fascination and devotion to the comics. So we're drawing upon a very deep creative influence in terms of in
the, I started in the collecting when I was 10 years old. It was very, you know, it was a strong emotional impact on me, these, the mythology of these characters.
What does Soderbergh think of it? Does he ever say to
he
you
loves
guys?
It. He sent an email to us like 6 months ago and he said we owe him a car. So
he doesn't look, but he also, he was not a comics fan. So he can't relate on that level.
Right.
But yeah.
Well, so this idea that Marvel is where you're home, you know, that these movies resonate with you. I'll invite you to dispel the version of Marvel that I've been told mm-hmm. when I've written about Marvel, which is you shoot whatever almost, and they say, we're going to take care of it later. And afterwards, their committee comes in and wham, bam, effects, whatever, and then boom, giant hit.
If you don't have a vision for what you're doing, yeah, sure, that can happen there, you know. But if you have a film that you're committed to and you're executing, that, you know, our experience was the exact opposite of that at Marvel.
It's no different than any other studio, and in fact, I think very easy to work at, because you're dealing directly with Kevin Feige.
If you're the right person to deal with Kevin Feige.
If you're the right person to fit into that environment in a way where, listen, at the end of the day, and James Gunn said this recently where he said like...
What's the director of Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right. Mm-hmm. He said that, you know, that he felt that us and he were making things that Kevin happen to like. And so he's, you know, he's been incredibly supportive of us.
Right.
We, you know, our director cut on both The Winter Soldier and... Civil War are virtually, you know, untouched. Of course, we, you know, you massage the material and you look for where you may have some story holes and, you know, we do some pickups. It's not dissimilar to the way that we used to work on Arrested and Community where we're constantly refining the episodes before they went to air.
I kind of skipped over the bit where Kevin contacts you. I mean,
sure.
Was your initial reaction to that like, yay, it's... I can't believe we had one phone call like this from Steven Soderbergh, but now Kevin Feige is calling us? Or is it like, do we want to go in there?
It was a little less specific than the Soderbergh phone call in the sense that we got a call from our agent one day that basically said, oh, Marvel has a list of 10 filmmakers that they want to talk to about the next Captain America movie, and you guys are on it.
Did
and it
you was say, like, well, how did we get on it?
Well, yeah, exactly. They hadn't solicited for it. And what we found out later was that Marvel simply comes up, and this I think speaks to a lot of how what their creative process is like over there. They simply come up with a list of people who are doing interesting work that they like, and they bring them in to talk to them, regardless of the fact that whether there may be a clear road to them ever actually directing the movie.
So which one was it? Did they say we loved?
We did some paintball episodes on Community that were action spoof episodes. And I think Kevin had looked at the episodes and said, well, these guys have a sense of humor and they also understand action. Because even though we're spoofing the genre, there were still a lot of action set pieces in the episodes. So they became sort of cult favorites of the audience, those episodes.
So you felt what? You were like, what? Kevin Feige?
Well, it was interesting because, you know, I was, as I said, a huge comic book fan. And so that's material that we have an emotional attachment to and the mythology that we understand. And, you know, and we like to deconstruct things. And Captain America is an interesting character to deconstruct. It's really what we did on Arrested and Community for years, was just pick things apart. You know, but it was hard to pull us out of TV because we had seen the trend firsthand that was happening, that's very evident now, is that content in television was becoming pretty radical and very interesting. You know, we were working on Community and Happy Endings at the same time. We were enjoying a really healthy run, and we were having our pick of pilots every year. And it was just, you know, it was a great working environment for us because, you know, the trick in the business, obviously, is when you have enough power to have control over the content.
Right.
And we were at that place. So it was definitely a risk for us to leave that environment and take a stab at another film. But we met with Kevin, and we absolutely hit it off. I think we grew up very similarly, had a lot of the same influences. We're all, Anth, I, and Kevin are all pop culture junkies in a way. And we like to dissect things, but also we also like to execute things that have a pop culture sensibility to them.
Coming up after a short break, the Russo brothers tell us how they got Marvel to cough up the bucks to put Iron Man in a Captain America movie. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to filmmakers Anthony and Joe Russo. Their most recent movie is Marvel's Captain America: Civil War, and they have already signed on to do two more big-budget comic book movies. This is the brothers' second movie with Captain America in the lead role, but he's hardly alone. The cast of superheroes includes Falcon, Black Widow, Ant-Man, the much-anticipated Black Panther, and a young Spider-Man, among others. This time around, these characters are split into opposing teams, one led by Captain America, or Chris Evans, and the other headed by Iron Man, that is, Robert Downey Jr.
If we can't accept limitations, we're no better than bad guys.
That's not the way I see it.
Sometimes I want to punch you in your perfect teeth.
Having Iron Man in the movie was not a simple proposition. The Russo brothers had to sell the idea to Marvel's Kevin Feige, as Anthony explains.
Once we had sort of pitched Kevin, you know, why we really wanted to do Civil War and what we would do with the Iron Man character in Civil War, and Kevin bought it, he said, all right, guys, now you got to go get Downey. Good luck. He was very supportive of the idea, but I think, it was a complicated proposition for Kevin because, look, Downey changes the financial equation.
That's what I was going to ask. You anticipated my question. Significant.
This was a Captain America movie, okay? So all of a sudden you're going to bring Robert Downey into the budget level of a Captain America movie.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it wasn't necessarily an easy road for Kevin, but he was intrigued by it on a creative level. And he thought if we could hook him creatively, meaning Downey, then there might be a road for him to figure it out financially.
Why was Kevin saying, oh, now you got to go get him?
Well, because one, you have to convince Robert on a creative level because he wasn't contracted to be in the film. Yeah. It was outside of his contract. Two, we are working on a movie called Captain America. It is not the Avengers brand, which is a much more lucrative brand in the marketplace. And so, you know, then we had to go convince the powers that be that it was worth increasing the budget exponentially.
Isn't Kevin the power that is?
At the time.
You know everybody has a boss?
Oh, there was Ike.
There was at the time.
You actually reminded me of, I wanted to ask you, did life change? Because Ike Perlmutter, obviously, who was at the time running Marvel and still runs Marvel, except for Kevin Feige, got out from under reporting to him.
We've been on that journey from Winter Soldier through Civil War, and it may have even been some story points in Civil War that may have caused the Civil War within Marvel. So,
ooh, that's intriguing.
Without getting into too much detail, I think that there were years where Kevin was absorbing a lot of the pain inflicted on the company.
Because Ike Perlmutter, just to be perfectly clear, really, really doesn't like to spend money.
And I think there are some misconceptions in the marketplace about who Kevin is because he was representing everybody in the process.
Oh, like Kevin got blamed for Ike. Mike, got it. I'll say the words.
And I think you're seeing some really compelling choices made on the directing front, both on the new Thor film and with Coogler on Panther. And I think, you know, the environment there is a much healthier, happier environment.
In other words, when you have a guy like Ryan Coogler, they will spring for him. Is that what we're saying in basic English?
I think without question. And, you know, they're interested in you know, some of the more compelling voices out there.
You guys, I mean, I am sort of in awe of the sitting in the screening room, and the credits are almost as long as the movie.
Yeah, without question. Yeah.
Literally hundreds and hundreds. I mean, we have a number. Do you know how many people work on
it? It takes a village. I don't know.
I'm sure it's over 1,000.
It must be over 1,000. Yeah. And this goes on and on. And I'm thinking, how do you do that?
Two of us.
I will say this. I mean, look, you know, everything is organized in a very hierarchical method. You know what I mean? Like a lot of those names you're seeing on that.
Right. They report to somebody who
reports
to somebody.
Yeah, we don't intersect with the vast majority of the names you see on the screen afterwards. You know, many of those names are in the visual effects department, which is, you know, I think at its height is like maybe 800 people on a movie like this, but we're only dealing with maybe a couple dozen.
It is truly like a military operation, I'm
Without
sure.
Without question.
And it with is. Major You're safety like, considerations.
Major safety considerations. We're doing a lot of stunts. There's a lot of explosions.
Marvel is a very well-run company for many, many reasons. But one of the things they do particularly well, and I think Joe and I are very grateful for because we had never worked at this scale before, is they're super well-organized in terms of how they organize these departments. So it's like it makes it very easy for filmmakers like us to come into their system and to be able to access what we need in order to create what we're looking to create. Really, the whole trick is preparation. Like when you're, the bigger the movie is, the more you have to prep, the earlier you have to prep because you have to communicate the vision for what you're trying to achieve to more people, and it's going to take them longer to do the work that you need them to do in order to be able to shoot.
And you also have to make decisions very quickly and be decisive. And if you, you know, I always say just make a decision and then figure out how to make it the right decision. And I think that that comes from working in television for all those years. And I think there's a reason you see a proliferation of TV folks in the film in films now with J.J. Abrams and Whedon and Judd Apatow and us. Is you want to be a carpenter, you got to make a lot of tables. In TV, you make a lot of tables every week.
Make a lot of tables.
Yeah.
You have said, Joe, so, I mean, do you think that independent cinema is going to cease to exist? Because I think you were quoted saying that.
That my interpretation, and just as this is being in a front row seat of making these movies and seeing where the business is going, is that it is, you know, and again, as a guy who has a few kids, so I also see what their media habits are. Trying to be predictive, my guess would be is that television is the new independent cinema because there is not a significant a financial metric involved in that market. You know, there's some very compelling storytelling going on there that is independently minded or independently spirited. And I think that what you're going to see with features moving forward, because now everybody has a flat screen television in their home. Everybody has access to an unlimited amount of really good content. That's fairly cheap content. If you're paying, you know, Netflix, you're paying $14.99 a month for that content. To go to the theater and spend $100, $150 by the time you get the sitter, you know, you go to dinner. You buy the popcorn.
God forbid you buy the popcorn,
right?
Yeah.
It's very difficult to get people to want to leave their houses now when they have so much distracting them in their home. And this isn't even including where VR could go very shortly and where, you know, and how the viewing habits of, you know, a younger demographic is being cultivated in a way that is very different than the last 100 years of, you know, cinematic viewing habits, you know, where we perceive stories as 2-hour close-ended, you know, content. Now their average viewing is a 4-minute piece. So, you know, where the business is going, I think, is that large companies are going to be buying pieces of the calendar with branded IP.
Well, it's happening, yeah.
Right?
So, but dated into 2020.
Exactly. And I think Star Wars now owns Christmas. Marvel owns May and November and potentially August, you know. Deadpool in February. You know, now we're proving that you can make money in any month. It's really about owning a date, which becomes then very difficult for smaller films to find release because these massive movies are occupying all the screens, they're occupying all the attention, all the media.
The noisy stuff right now, we're definitely in a period now where the global marketplace is really getting cohesive. You know, these movies are opening everywhere,
right,
more so day and date. So you're having these experiences where all across the world, you know, audiences can have a communal experience of a movie together, which is really, I think, a fantastic development in sort of the history, not just of cinema, but of like of our world, the growth of our world.
Driven by social media.
Yeah, it's a very interconnected world nowadays. And so, I think, you know, there's a heightened sense of these movies, the power of these movies right now, simply because you can send ripples through the global marketplace with them. Not ripples, but big waves through the global marketplace. But the more that becomes the norm, then, you know, attention will shift to the niches in the industry.
Yeah, but you'll find that, I mean, Netflix's valuation and compared to most studios is significant. They may become the future of sub $100 million movies. They may find their own niche. I mean, I think that the studios will work hard to differentiate their content from what you can get on a Netflix or an Amazon, which is why these event movies are important.
You have to go to the theater if you really want to enjoy.
Yes.
Joe and Anthony Russo are the directors of Captain America: Civil War. Thank you guys so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.